Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Don McAllister, host of Screencast Online. Don, good afternoon. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, John. Yeah, no problem. Thanks for inviting me.
We've been on Mac Jury together,
mm-hmm.
and we had a good time. That's how I got to know you.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it's been a while, actually. We'll have to bother Chuck and get back on there again.
Yeah, that's always fun. And you are in Liverpool.
That's right. That's right. And thanks for arranging this at a sensible time as well. So it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon here, which is great. I don't know what time it is in your neck of the woods.
Well, we turned our clocks ahead an hour about a week ago. So instead of having to get up really early, I'm only 6 hours behind you instead of seven.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Really,
that's
well.
Not too bad. No. Yeah, another couple of weeks and we'll change again. But well.
So I've got some questions for you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to learn more about you since we've, you know, casually been on podcasts together and things like that. And I've been following you and reading your blogs and stuff. So I want to learn more about your early career. You know, we are where we are now. Mm-hmm. That's always fun to find out how you got where you are.
Right. Yeah. It's it's a fairly long career at my stage of life as well. So I won't sort of go into too many details or tell you all the different jobs. But I mean, basically, I sort of left school and drifted into various jobs. One of my very, very earliest jobs was as a guy in a music shop. One of my hobbies was playing the bass, and I managed to get a summer job playing in a music shop, and that was a really good experience. And I sort of went into office-based jobs. Of course, at the time when I was first looking for work, there were no computers, or rather, there were no computers that people had in their homes. There were no personal computers. So I sort of went into various clerical jobs, worked for the government for a while, doing clerical and administrative jobs, worked my way up through there. Ended up in what we call over here the Health and Safety Executive, which is a government department looking at health and safety in the workplace. And it's around about that time.
That's an interesting word, executive. Tell us how that relates to the.
Yeah, it
US
was
system.
Well, it was like an inspectorate of people. So we used to both sort of do the regulations, but also we had a team of investigators.
Mm-hmm.
They would go out and make sure that the regulations were enforced and do inspections and stuff. So,
sort of yeah, like the Environmental Protection Agency or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. So that was really interesting. I sort of ran a small office there with a small team of inspectors, sort of looking after them and making sure everything was sorted out. So that was fairly interesting. And it was actually in the Health and Safety Executive that I sort of developed an interest in computing. So
what
I
kind
sort
of computers
across.
Were they using?
At the time, we had there was a suite of mini computers that were sort of based around the country, but we were actually starting to, in work at least, use HP personal computers. The very first touchscreens, in fact, they were little 10-inch touchscreens, monochrome displays, but they would run. They are IBM PC compatible computers. And you know, they would run standard word processing and spreadsheets and database applications. I mean, prior to that, we had the home computers, you know, the Sinclair Spectrum, the ZX81, which is where I really started sort of getting my interest in computers. But I was lucky enough to be able to sort of switch streams in work and go from a clerical job to a job in an IT department.
Did you have to take any training, or did you just sort of naturally self-teach yourself?
No, I sort of pretty much, on the Sinclair Spectrum, I don't know if you had them in the US, but the Sinclair Spectrum.
I remember those, yeah.
Yeah, there were some of the very, very early computers, not long after the original, because I wasn't into Apple at all at this time. I didn't know. In fact, I think this probably predates Apple, but we didn't really get much exposure to Apple computers in the UK. But the very earliest hobbyist computers were, things that you could program yourself. They ran BASIC, and you could create your own computer programs. And I was pretty much self-taught. I did get a couple of programs, because those were the days when they used to submit programs to magazines, and they would actually print out code.
Yeah, I did that.
And you'd
too.
Have to type in all the
yeah,
instructions.
Oh, I wrote goodness. Some articles on Apple II high-res graphics, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. So I spent many hours typing in code and managed to learn it, and then developed a couple of programs of my own and put them in. Even sold a few copies as well, which was fascinating at the time. Yeah.
How did you? a question. Yeah. How did the Apple II percolate into the UK? Well, you know, it really took off in the United States, and there was the competitors, the Commodore PET and the TRS-80. But the Apple II was really well instantiated in the United States in, you know, 78 to 84. Did it percolate into the UK in the same way, or did you guys have your own homebrew?
Yeah, not at all. Yeah, we had let's say the Sinclair Spectrum was probably the most well-known sort of home computer. We did see the Commodore PET, we saw the TRS machines come out as well. We had our sort of but the IBM PC really took off in a big way in the UK. And there is
that was 81.
Yeah, and there's a brand called Amstrad, which is sort of like, again, a UK-based company, but they went big into IBM PC compatibles and developed their own sort of range.
Oh, so they were like the Compaq of the UK.
Yeah, yeah, sort of. And to be honest, Apple was just not on the horizon. In fact, I don't remember seeing an Apple. The first Apple machine I saw was when I was working the health and safety executive. And the only reason I saw that, we were all IBM PC, and but the graphics department commissioned a suite of Apple machines. And to this day, I don't know what they were, unfortunately, to my embarrassment. There was, you know, big, powerful Apple machines. They looked fairly substantial, and they were very expensive. But and I think we actually bought three or four of them, and I just sort of arranged for them to be commissioned and installed. But they did their own support. You know, we didn't touch them. In fact, I don't think I actually saw them again after the day that we got them installed. So, you know, we never saw. I mean, Apples as home machines, we never saw. Working in the corporate environment, I never saw Apples laptops or being used as business machines. So it was only really until, well, literally, 2000s before they really did start to make any inroads into the UK.
Wow, that's really interesting. So the desktop publishing market didn't really kick in like it did.
They probably did, but you know, they were very insular. I mean, I didn't really. I mean, not for the home. No, I don't think so. I mean, there obviously were sort of purists or real fans that would go out and get them, but they were so expensive here in the UK that I don't think they made any inroads into the personal computer market.
Are they expensive because of that value-added tax that's applied or import tax aside?
I think just at the time it was just the difference between, you know, the UK and the US and the cost to actually get them imported, because we didn't really have, I mean, there were certainly no Apple dealers at that time. So you would have had to, you know, find someone in the States who'd be prepared to ship one over to you. I mean, there might be people listening to this now going, "Hang on, I had an Apple II back in the day," and I'm in the UK. But I'm just as a normal person who didn't really have sort of exposure to the Apple environment. You know, it wasn't very obvious at the time.
Well, let's jump forward a second here now. Mm-hmm. Today, in 2016, there must be Apple retail stores sprinkled all around London.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean the past 10 years, you know, it's just exploded over here in the UK. We used to have Apple resellers, lots of Apple resellers. We had no Apple stores, but we had Apple resellers. So they were doing good business, you know, when Apple did start to make inroads. But now we've got I think we've got 20 or 30 Apple stores now in the UK.
Wow.
Must
have five or six in London, I would guess.
Yeah, probably three or four big ones and some dotted around. And so, yeah, some places now have, all the major cities pretty much have Apple stores. I think there are still pockets. I mean, over in Northern Ireland, they don't have that many, but there are some in Scotland. And again, not many in Wales, but lots in England, you know, England and Scotland.
Are there any that are sort of notable architecturally, like the glass cube or the one in Beijing?
They have taken some prime positions. There's a couple in London that are quite well known, like the Regent Street store is quite well known. And they just basically follow the same strategy of both having sort of mall-based stores, but also in the larger towns, you know, they will try and look for interesting buildings that they can take over. So I think the Regent Street store, the Covent Garden store is quite nice. That's quite interesting. They're the two main ones that I know of in London.
Now, at some point in this process, you get very interested in Macs, despite the lack of Apple's notoriety in the country. How did that happen?
Well, it was very strange. I mean, I went from the health and safety executive into corporate IT at that point and sort of looking at sort of big systems. And I'd always been a big fan of computers and computing. You know, I used to make my own PCs from scratch, you know, with motherboards and graphics cards. And it was went into upgrading and everything. But I'd sort of lost my mojo in the 90s. I'd sort of become a bit jaded, a bit fed up with Windows and PCs. They didn't seem to progress as fast as I wanted them to. So it was 2004, I think it must have been 2004, 2005. I actually just stumbled across Steve Jobs keynote, just browsing the net, and in YouTube I came across the keynote where he actually launched, or he talked about photos, or iPhoto as it was then, and the books that you could make, you know, the photo books, which I thought was interesting, and a couple of other bits of software, which again, you know, looked interesting. And then at the end, they announced the Mac Mini, and sort of my ears sort of pricked up because it was an entry level machine. You didn't need to have a keyboard or a monitor. It was very affordable as well. So I just thought, well, you know, everything they've shown in the keynote's been interesting. Let's go and get one of these Mac Minis and we'll see what it's all about. And it must have been 2005. That was in the January. I was actually in the States a couple of months later on business.
Was that an Intel?
It wouldn't have been. It would have been a PowerPC, the very first one. So I was in the States a couple of months later, but I couldn't get one in the States. So it took about 6 months for them to come out, or about 5 months for them to come out to the UK. So I got one later on that year, and you know, used it for a couple of days. I was sold, hook, line, and sinker. I loved it. I thought it was really, really great. And I was astounded at its performance, even though it was a tiny machine. I sort of got into video editing, just home video editing, and found that I could use iMovie on that. And actually, while it was rendering, I could actually do other things on it as well, which was astounding to me. I mean, on my Intel machines, I sort of set things off rendering and, you know, it'd kill the machine.
That's cool. Well, that's the advantage of integrating the hardware and the software. Knows what it can do instead of trying to muscle the hardware into something it doesn't want to do.
So that was great. So, you know, here we are, you know, 10 years later, and it's, I've long given up the Windows environment, and everything is all Mac and all iOS now, of course, as well.
Yeah, that's a pretty impressive set of equipment you've got on your website, on your blog. I see a Mac Pro there sitting in the background.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's sort of like my main production machine that I work with. But, you know, I've got iPads and MacBooks and all everything you'd expect. The nice thing is we're doing the screencast as well, that, you know, I do need to have all the different things for testing things, for trying things out, for setting up demo rigs, you know, for just being knowledgeable about the equipment, so that, you know, when I go on to various podcasts, I can do my bit and be knowledgeable about the kit and how it all hangs together.
So at some point, you got interested in the idea of converting your video expertise into the screencasting.
Well, that was, again, that was in the very early days. In fact, it was the Mac Mini, again, that sort of was the catalyst for that, because I'd sort of evangelized to my friends and relatives about the Mac after getting this Mac Mini, and one of them actually decided to try it out for herself, and she bought, I can't remember now, I think, yeah, she might have bought a Mac Mini, or it might have been a MacBook. But basically, she was, this is one of my relatives, was a PC user, never used a Mac before. So I did a couple of video tutorials for her just to guide her through the basics of what she needed to do and how she could use things, you know, Safari, etc. And at the time, I'd sort of toyed with the idea. This was the summer of 2005, and podcasting hadn't been out that long, and I was sort of getting into podcasting, you know, listening to podcasts. I used to listen to Adam Christensen on the MacCast, and I thought it might be a good idea to do a podcast about a new Mac.
Still doing that. He's also our webmaster at the Mac Observer.
Ah, right. Okay. I know Adam well now. I've met him quite a few times now. But yeah, I sort of had the idea of doing an audio podcast and just sort of telling my experiences of being a new Mac user and guiding people through the process. And that didn't really work out. It wasn't really the format for me. And I didn't find it comfortable sitting down. In fact, the first time I sat down to record my inaugural podcast, after sorting all the tech out and getting the domain name set up, and you know, I sort of sat down in front of the mic and then didn't really know what to talk about. So it was a bit, I sort of
gave
up.
That's hard to
believe. Yeah, well, the audio format wasn't doing it for me. You know, it's had you. I found it difficult to explain things using the audio format. So I thought, well, hang on, I've done these videos for my relative. That's just a media file. Why don't I sort of publish these few as a podcast, and I'll do a few more and put them on the stream and see how it goes. And that was the start of it, really. I used to post a video tutorial, just a short 10-minute one or 15-minute one, you know, every week as a free podcast. And then over the course of 12 months, that went from being, you know, a hobby to things that people wanted to donate to basically a full-blown occupation. 12 months later, I gave up my full-time job and started the podcast up not a fully paid service, but, you know, a membership system, and really haven't looked back since then.
That sounds like a great place for us to take a break.
Sure.
I want to take a short commercial break right now, and when I come back, I have a whole bunch of more questions for you. But right now, we're going to take a short break, folks. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thank you, Kelly. Well, Don, I wanted to kind of marry two ideas here. You got started with this technology of screencasting because it was a better way to explain, and then you made a decision to get the Mac Pro for production. Mm-hmm. Tell me why the Mac Pro turned out to be the right answer for you. I know you have some MacBooks.
Yeah, I mean, I do still use the MacBook in the production process, but mainly for recording screencasts. And then I use the Mac Pro for pretty much everything else, really. It's just one of those machines that, you know, it just keeps going no matter what you throw at it. It's quite a powerful machine. Also, I know you can get 64 gig iMacs now. The new 5K iMacs can be expanded. But, you know, I wanted to put a lot of RAM in there. I like the expandability of the 6 Thunderbolt ports as well, because I have lots of Thunderbolt drives.
Were you motivated to use your own screen as well instead of being locked into, say, an iMac?
I did have the Thunderbolt displays, the cinema displays. I had two cinema displays, which I was using. I've since sort of migrated to a standard 4K screen.
Oh, I'm going to talk to you about that too. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's quite a nice setup. I did actually, when the iMac 5Ks came out, I did actually get one. But it wasn't that long after I'd bought the Mac Pro. And to be honest, the iMac 5K was a great machine. It was very powerful. It did everything I needed it to do. But I just couldn't justify keeping both that and the Mac Pro. It sort of didn't fit into my workflow. Mm-hmm. So I actually did send the 5K iMac back and ended up just getting a standard 4K monitor to put onto the Mac Pro. Now, whether or not that, you know, I'll stay with this configuration, I'm not sure. We'll have to see what happens with Apple's decision on how it, if it comes out with a standalone 5K machine, or what they do with the Mac Pro as well. So I'm open to the fact if I need to upgrade, it wouldn't really bother me, to go to a 5K iMac, because I like a desktop machine. I like a laptop machine, but, you know, if I'm actually working at my desk, I like a proper desktop machine to work from.
Are you as annoyed as I am with Apple about their 27-inch Thunderbolt display being 5 years old?
It's crazy.
With USB 2 and MagSafe 1 and Thunderbolt 1. And,
yeah.
What's Apple going to do? They dropped themselves into this never land, you know?
Well, especially since they've, you know, how long have they been producing Retina displays on their laptops? I mean, once you get used to a Retina display on the laptop, to actually go to a Thunderbolt display, you know, with this low res screen, it's painful. It really is. I mean, they're lovely monitors, and for their time, they were great. They are very expensive as well. You know, they did have an Apple tax, but to still have them now, being so long in the tooth, it's just amazing.
Well, it's the only display you can put in the Apple Store to connect to the Mac Pros. And the Mac Pro is getting kind of long a tooth here. I think the WWDC this summer will be 3 years since it was first announced.
Yeah, but you can't even connect it to a Mac, you know, the new MacBook with the USB-C port. You actually can't connect it to that at all.
Yeah, because it's only Thunderbolt, right? It doesn't have a DisplayPort connector.
That's right. It's only Thunderbolt. So it sucks, basically.
It does.
So I've actually got two of them still. As I say, I use an LG 4K machine. I've got two of the Thunderbolt displays, one of which is actually sitting in a box that I really need to sell. And the other one is I have a walking desk, you know, with the treadmill underneath. And I've actually put one of the Thunderbolt displays on that walking desk. So that sort of stuck there. And whenever I use that, I just plug my MacBook Pro. It works with the MacBook Pro still, of course. And I plug that in. Or I run a long Thunderbolt cable across from my Mac Pro and just plug that into the back of the Thunderbolt display. But it's let's get things in perspective. It doesn't hurt my eyes, but I would much prefer to have a Retina display on all my screens.
So that was probably why you bought the 4K display to attach to the Mac Pro, right? Because from looking at your desk setup, you're sitting kind of close.
Yes. Yeah. So I have, I keep chopping and changing, but yeah, I currently have a 4K, which is connected by DisplayPort into the Mac Pro, and set it up to high DPI. And it's really nice. It's a very nice monitor.
What kind is it?
It's an LG, or rather an LG, but which particular one it is, I'm not sure. Let me have a quick look, because I'm actually sitting in front of it now. Let me have a quick look at system preferences. That should tell me. It's a 30. Let's see. I've got two monitors connected now. It's the 31-inch. So it's the 31MU97.
And you only need one DisplayPort line connected to the Mac Pro.
That's right. Yeah. It has one of those big clunky DisplayPorts on the back of it, but that goes into a Thunderbolt connector, which goes into the back of the Mac Pro. And then I also have an ultra-wide monitor as well, which isn't, you can put it in a high DPI, but in its native format, it's not high DPI. And that's another LG, which is one of the 34-inch ultra-wide ones, the 34UM95 display. And that's just a nice, long, extended wide display for when I'm doing video editing. You know, I can have a nice long timeline up in that one.
Do you use the 4K TV to double as for watching television, or do you not have that ability?
No, it has HDMI. I use it for the Apple TV now and again, because it's got a nice switching mechanism. So if I'm working on the Apple TV, I can actually just switch over to the Apple TV and view that on the screen. Or I can actually switch it into dual screen mode, so I can have my Mac Pro in one window on the machine and the Apple TV in a separate window on the machine as well, which is quite nice.
While we're on the subject, I'm curious about 4K in the UK. Are you able to watch Netflix in 4K there?
Yes. Yeah. I actually did buy, I think it's a Samsung 4K TV. It must be 12 months ago now. That's sitting in the front room. And yeah, I can get the Netflix 4K service. That's about the only service I think that's being sort of transmitted.
Are you keen to buy a ultra high definition Blu-ray player? Just curious.
Not really. Not really, because I'm not really into physical media. I don't really collect media as such. I've got a DVD collection, but I sort of stopped that a couple of years ago. We have Amazon 4K as well. Mm-hmm. Amazon has certain titles in 4K. But I use the 4K TV, really. It does upscale HD content quite nicely. And also, you know, unless you're sitting quite close, when it's displaying a true 4K image, there's this problem of distance from the screen. Right. unless you get quite close, you know, within 5 or 6 foot of even, I think this one's a 55 inch TV. Unless you're within, say, 6 foot of the TV, you can't really get the full benefits of the true 4K picture. So you really need to have an enormous screen.
You know, the industry is working on solving that problem. It's something called high dynamic range. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of it. I know that was quite prevalent around CES this year.
Right. The industry is very well aware of the fact that people kind of have that approach where they say, well, I don't sit close enough to have to buy a new TV. But when you see HDR in action and you see the enormous range from dark to bright, and pictures that are washed out in the old system that are crisp and high contrast in the new system, then you say, wow, I can see that at any distance. And so the 4K TV industry is all about the business of bringing HDR into their TVs. And I'm really interested in getting one of those maybe at Christmas time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think 4K, I mean, we had the whole 3D thing with TVs, which never ever took off. As far as I can see, it was never ever going to take off anyway. I think 4K is different from that. I don't think it's just the TV companies trying to sell us new technology for us all to refresh the screens. I do think, you know, 4K is the way that, you know, broadcast and internet-based delivery systems will adopt. So, and it's very difficult to actually buy a TV without 4K these days, and the prices have tumbled down, you know. So it is a technology that's with us and is you know, going to be advanced on.
I was in this discount plan, what do you call it, a subscription community called Costco in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw a 55-inch 1080p TV for
$399. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Pretty soon you won't be able to buy them at all, but right now they're just trying to make some money unloading the old ones. And the prices are amazing for 1080p. I think you could buy like a 40-inch for maybe $199.
Yes, it's mind you, have to think, you know, with virtual reality and augmented reality, how long it's going to be before we have these all built into our eyewear. But that might take a couple more years yet.
How are you feeling about heavy glass computer devices hanging on your face? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting developments. And I think over time, in fact, I think one of the companies that are sort of spearheading this sort of new movement are saying that, you know, within 5 years, it will basically just be a thin perspex or thin plastic. Basically, it's just like eyewear is now. So, you know, we won't have all this
heavy. To get there. Yeah,
it's got to get there. It's got to be miniaturized. It's got to be refined. But within five or 7 years, they say it will be very lightweight and unobtrusive. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Okay, so moving on. Tell me more about how you do your screencasts. I'm curious about the tools that you use, how you capture the video, how you construct the script and the process, and how you publish. Kind of walk us through that if you can.
Okay. Well, the scripting, I do very little sort of scripting, and the choice of tutorials are I'm very flexible. I don't really plan too far ahead so that I can sort of be pretty responsive for when things happen or if new software comes out. But I sort of try and choose subjects or topics that I sort of feel that would be of interest to me if I was watching as a viewer. So, you know, the selection process is fairly flexible. And of course, now I sort of have to cover the Mac, iOS, tvOS, and Apple Watch as well. So rather than doing, as I have in the past, doing separate iOS and Mac shows, I now sort of do combined shows where if it's a common topic, you know, I'll cover the Mac and the iOS and, if necessary, the Apple Watch aspects or tvOS aspects all in the same show, so like a combined show. So I tend not to script it. What I will tend to do is perhaps script an introduction and then do an outline of the sorts of topics that I want to cover, set up all the materials that I might need to demonstrate the various aspects of the software or the concept I'm trying to put across. And then what I tend to do is have a separate MacBook Pro, which is my recording machine. So I'll stick an external monitor into that and record the screen off the laptop and also have my editing software on the second monitor, so I can sort of record a bit and then edit it, record a bit more, edit it a bit more. I tend to do it that way. I actually use ScreenFlow as my primary both capture and editing tools. ScreenFlow, it's a great app. It's about $99. It allows you to capture the desktop off your Mac and edit it as well. So it's not just a capture tool, it's capture and editing. And you can also export in various formats from ScreenFlow. So it's a great all-round tool for doing what I do. It's purpose-made. I have sort of toyed with the idea of using Final Cut Pro or something, but, you know, for what I need, I'll use Final Cut Pro for normal movie editing, but for screencasts, I use the Optimize program. It also has now capabilities of capturing iOS devices. You know, you can do
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, you can plug a lightning cable into an iOS device, and you can capture in ScreenFlow. To be honest, I tend not to do that, though. I tend to use QuickTime and record iOS separately as QuickTime files, and then bring those into ScreenFlow and edit them and combine them with any of the footage that I have. So, but that's just a personal preference of mine.
How do you publish them, then?
Publishing is done, there's a whole post-production process once the video has been mm-hmm. recorded. So I do sort of like an assembly edit, put it all together, and the video goes off to another editor who goes through and sort of double checks what I've done, puts a top and tail on it, puts the chapter markings in, and then that is then passed back to me. I export it in its final form, and then I have another set of people who do transcription, who do some of the post-production process, setting up the web pages for the show, sorting out the subtitles, so they take the transcription and turn those into subtitles. And then there's a content management system, sort of a custom one that we've designed and developed, and it all gets put in there. And then when the day comes around, when the show is due to be published, it will just get published. It gets pushed out as RSS feeds. It gets published on the website so people can actually have a look at the shows on the website. We also have now some apps. So we have an Apple TV app for the members. So the show appears on the Apple TV now, so people can watch it on the Apple TV. More recently, nice. There's an iOS and Apple TV app for non-members, because the actual show itself is a subscription service.
How much does that cost?
It works out about, if you go for the annual subscription, which is like the best value, it's about $72 for the year, which works out about $6 a month. But people can pay quarterly or monthly for slightly higher. That's $7 a month for a quarter or $8 for a monthly membership. But that includes, you know, everything. That includes the archive. It includes the weekly shows. Includes the magazine as well. I do a Screencast Online monthly magazine, which is an iPad and iPhone magazine. And that contains the previous month's videos in streamable format, and also a series of articles and interesting bits and pieces from some of my friends in the Apple community. Then they have the Apple TV app as well, so they can watch it on the Apple TV. But the new app, which is for non-members, people can go in and actually buy individual episodes if they want and stream them to their iPad, their iPhone, or to the Apple TV. That's something called the SEO Showcase. And that's a relatively new thing that only came out about 6 weeks ago.
Very cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, Don, we only have a few minutes left, and I have one question for you left
sure.
time remaining, and that is, I know you watched the Apple event on the 21st.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Tell us how you felt about that, because I've seen mixed feelings about that event for a lot of different people.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. I mean, I wasn't expecting anything different. I know people sort of... It's not as bad as it used to be, but people used to get so wound up about, you know, what's coming. But now, you know, we get so many leaks and things are sort of pre-announced by people who seem to be in the know that my expectations weren't very high for the event. So we knew there was going to be a new iPhone, which is going to be a smaller one. We knew there was going to be a new iPad Pro that was going to be a smaller one. If there was a surprise, great. But if there wasn't, it was only the town hall. You know, it was a short event. So I sort of was quite happy with what I saw. I think the two devices that they announced, if you put aside the environmental thing, which I think is super cool, you know, they are doing a lot with the environment, and also the research stuff that they're doing as well. I think that's very significant for the future.
It is.
yeah, I think that's again, and it's, you know, it's a very Apple-like thing to do, very altruistic in what they're doing. But so that aside, you know, the actual product releases, you know, I can see exactly why they've done it and on which segments of the market they're trying to hit. Yet there are people who don't like big phones. You know, there are people who are hating the fact that when they come to upgrade their iPhone, they would have had to go for an iPhone 6, which is too big for them. So to package up, you know, a modern or the latest tech in a smaller form factor, it's just a no-brainer, really. That they had to do it, or they, you know, ostracize a lot of their current customers, and they can bring new customers in, you know, with a lesser expensive phone but still have all the modern technology. So the phone's great. The iPad Pro was a bit of a surprise. I did think they called it the iPad Pro Mini or something to differentiate it.
But, that's the problem.
It's just the iPad
Pros, and the one's a 9.7 and one's a 12.9. Yeah, everybody's annoyed with that.
It makes it hard for us, sort of people who write about it and talk about it a lot, to differentiate between. That's the main. But for other people, you know, it's an iPad Pro, it's a small one or a big one. I was quite surprised how much extra stuff they've put in the smaller version. Because I did think, well, you know, the big iPad Pro is going to be, you know, the beefier machine, the one with the more capabilities. But as it turns out, that the new iPad Pro is actually better in many instances.
I think they're trying to rethink the whole iPad line and breathe some new life into it and boost sales.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a great machine. It's a no-brainer for anybody who wants to upgrade from a standard iPad Air. You know, they can go straight to the Pro. They've got the same form factor, but they've got all the added things of this, you know, nice new camera. They've got the support for the Apple Pencil. They've got this new display technology, this True Tone, which looks interesting. So I'll have to check that out.
Do you have to have one?
I think I'm going to have
it. You know, if you're going to explore these technologies, you got to own them first, right?
You've got to try them. That's and then, of course, necessary. Apple doesn't give many away. So, but you know, I'm not one of these people who thinks that, you know, I can't live on an iPad. I still need my Mac. If I'm going traveling, I can't just take an iPad away with me. It's got to be a Mac.
Like
so, what I've been doing is been taking my MacBook, which is fine for while I'm working away. And an iPad Air, because I've got the big iPad Pro and I love it. It's great. It's smashing around the house. You know, I love it to bits, but it's just too big to take away with me. So
I think a regular little MacBook, 12 inch, perfect for travel.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But I do enjoy using the iPad as well for certain things. So now I'll take the MacBook and I will take an iPad Pro as well, but it will be the smaller iPad Pro, much more manageable.
Cool. Well, guess what? We have overrun our time.
Didn't feel like it.
No, it was fun. It's fun. I didn't get a chance to ask you about cats. One of the things I've noticed is that all the people I interview have cats. Writers.
Yeah, we have two.
I knew it.
In fact, I'm surprised you haven't heard them in the background. Normally they come up and have a bit of a whine in the background, but
I'm going to have to explore this further. I have this theory that the Macintosh writers always have cats. I haven't found an exception yet. This is cool. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Thanks for being on the show. This was fun. One final thing. Tell the listeners how to contact you on Twitter or however else.
Well, if they want to check out my tutorials, there's the Screencast Online website over at screencastonline.com, and people can sign up for a 14-day, no-obligation free trial. They can have a look at the stuff. There's the magazine. Just look for Screencast Online magazine in the App Store, and this new app, SEO Showcase. And also, if they want to contact me on Twitter, it's just Don McAllister on Twitter.
Excellent. Thanks again. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for coming by. This was a lot of fun, and so we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.